This is News and Notes. I'm Ed Gordon. On today's roundtable, a study shows some Latinos have negative views of blacks, and police tie the rise in violent crime to juveniles. Joining us today to discuss these topics from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C., Joe Davidson. He's an editor at the Washington Post. Michael Myers, executive director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition, joins us via phone today from New York City. And Nat Irvin, professor of future studies at Wake Forest University, is at member station WFDD in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And Michael, we appreciate you joining us today as a late save, as a guest could not make it, so we appreciate that. All right, let's talk about a study from Duke University. Taken in 2003 from a survey of 500 Hispanic, black, and white residents in Durham, North Carolina. What was really interesting is Joe Davidson, the findings within this study, where Latino immigrants often held negative views of African Americans, most likely, the study believes, brought about by the fact that many of them came from more segregated Latin American countries, and therefore bringing those prejudices here.
You know, one of the interesting things about this report, I think, is that often when we find negative attitudes toward black people overseas, we attribute that to white people from America essentially transmitting those views to the others who live elsewhere. This report, though, indicates that the Latino immigrants have far harsher, far more negative attitudes toward black Americans than do the whites who were surveyed by significant margins. Now, I think one possible explanation for that is that when you ask somebody, a white person in this particular example, whether or not he or she has a negative attitude, they are probably less likely to acknowledge that. And furthermore, the Latino immigrants also get a great deal of their information, I'm sure, from the negative stereotypes that are pervaded on television, and also through, in many cases, our own rap music. So I think that I do find that interesting, though, the large discrepancy in the number or the percentage of Latinos who have these negative views and this much smaller percentage, less than 10% in each case, of the white population that claim to have these negative views.
And a southern white population at that, if you believe the vestiges of racism remain stronger in the south than the north. I'm not sure that I accept that. But Nat, let me ask you, as relates to the idea of what else was found in this study, and that was a connection that Latinos found or thought that they had with whites, a closer connection than to African Americans, yet the reverse of that was not found, that that whites did not necessarily find this connection, this bond, if you will, toward Latinos.
Yeah, that was kind of surprising, that sort of aspirational aspect of who the majority would be, and they would aspire to be, quote, as they, whatever they thought the majority represented, white folks in this instance, whatever the values were, that they would aspire to be more like them. I think that the study is not actually surprising, though, Ed. I live in North Carolina, lived in Texas, visited Mexico many times, and, you know, this particular snapshot is, if you were to take a similar study of America right around the beginning of the 20th century, I bet you'd find the same kinds of attitudes that Italians, whites, and Irish would have toward each other, particularly the immigrants toward other immigrants. And, you know, this, to me, looks more like it's a struggle of class as opposed to just race and ethnicity, although I think clearly, you know, those you can't discount the interrelation of those two. But in North Carolina, here's the important thing, I think, for the study. North Carolina is seen, as you know, the fastest growing percentage growth of Hispanics. By 2015, there'll be more Latino students in college than there will be, or that is approaching being ready to go to college, than African Americans. So this is an important study for that reason. But I think this is more of a prelude. I don't think that it necessarily is the picture for how race relations between blacks and Latinos will be in the future.
Michael, the study also showed the more educated the Hispanic respondent and the more social contact that they had with blacks, the less likely they were to harbor these negative stereotypes. But interestingly enough, in all of these studies, or many of these studies, I shouldn't say all, but many of these studies, no matter what the racial component, African Americans often find themselves the bottom rung of the ladder.
Well, that is so, because there is a prejudice and a negative attitude towards blacks across the world, and I think part of that is media, part of that is TV, part of that is cultural, in terms of people learn negative attitudes about blacks, and they have and they see blacks at, as you say, at the bottom, and therefore they want to feel better and be better and identify themselves as better than the lowest rung of people. It's all ignorance. Although I must tell you, there are a lot of educated people who carry stereotypes, and there are people who live with blacks who still carry those stereotypes. In fact, part of the study suggested that Latinos who were in close proximity to blacks in Durham were fearful of them because of quote-unquote crime. But the notion, the term Latino, is too general a term for me. There are black Latinos. There are brown Latinos, as well as white Latinos. So my question is, what color are these people who are saying they don't like blacks? And even as they have a response from whites, who have less negative attitude towards blacks than the immigrant Latino. Also, there has been studies about immigrant Latinos, again, using that term loosely, negative attitude towards Jews. So this, I think it is a problem of education, a problem of cultural stereotypes, and a reflection of people's attitude towards social problems. And they see blacks at the bottom and see blacks as social problems.
Yeah, but Joe, it probably has less to do with the hue of the person, having lived in Washington and in New York now. And clearly there would be Hispanics, Latinos, whatever tag we want to give, that are far darker than I, that still would see me as black and them as not.
Interesting.
Well, yeah, I think that other studies have shown, and this one too for that matter, that Latino people, generally speaking, and it's certainly true, there are black Latinos, no question about it, millions of them, but generally speaking, they tend to identify, certainly in this country, more with the white population than the black population. And I think that in certain segments of the Latino population, certainly in the Cubans in Miami, for example, most of them are identifiable as white people, just to look at them. I mean, I think this is a very complex issue when you start talking about race and ethnicity yeah. within the Latino yeah. population. Having said that, though, I there's much in this study that rings true, even though the term Latino is used very generally.
All right, let's turn our attention to the lawsuit brought about by Valerie Plame, the woman whose husband, Joseph Wilson, former U.S. ambassador, accused the Bush White House of revealing her identity, this after his belief that he was being spanked, if you will, for criticizing the Bush administration for going to war. 10 unnamed officials, and Karl Rove, Scooter Libby, and Dick Cheney as named officials in this, which suggested that these people conspired to not only out Valerie Plame's CIA identity, but to ruin her career, Michael Myers.
Yeah, I think. What else do you do when you only have one person indicted, and that is indicted for conspiracy and lying? Valerie Plame wants justice. She wants information. She wants discovery. The civil lawsuit will bring out some very interesting stuff when you put people in depositions and you ask them all kinds of questions about what they did, what they knew, and who they told, that she can't get now in a criminal setting. And it also suggests that this whole situation of outing, to use a word, of Valerie Plame by government officials who just leaked a CIA person's identity, this issue will dog the Bush administration long after Bush and Cheney leaves office. It will dog them unless Bush does something which I predict he will do, and that is issue at the last minute pardons to everybody who were loyal to him.
Interesting thought there, Joe Davidson, because as we have seen historically, the preponderance of evidence is far less in a civil trial than a criminal trial. So we know that Scooter Libby is the only one continuing to be on the hook on the criminal side. So it'll be interesting to see what happens, particularly with the vice president, as this plays itself out.
Yeah, that's true. Two points. One on Michael's point about the pardon. Even if that does happen, that's not going to stop people from dogging the Bush administration. it will just raise that ante much more, just as it did with Gerald Ford when he pardoned Richard Nixon. It certainly did not stop any criticism of Gerald Ford. It raised it to a new level. And I think that
but then the yellow office.
Well, that's true, but it's not. But all Republicans won't, and Republicans will still be running for office. And I think that the major thing with this lawsuit, though, is not so much whether or not Joe Wilson and Ms. Plame will win or not, not even whether they have a good case or not, but it is a point that Michael raised about the issue of discovery and the ability of these plaintiffs to subpoena people and get them on the stand and ask them questions that are not being asked in any other forum, certainly not under oath, because the scope of this civil action is different than the scope of the criminal action that's now proceeding against Libby. And so there are many more issues that can be gotten into, who told what to whom,
yeah,
when, that kind of thing. And that can have huge political ramifications, even if their case really doesn't go anywhere legally.
Nat, it'll be fun to see how elastic the term national security becomes in terms of what can be said and what cannot.
I tell you, I'm not sure whether this is more of a publicity stunt or if it's a lawsuit, but I tell you what, a lot of lawyers are about to get paid. I don't know. How do you prove a case like this? I mean, of course, Joe and Michael pointed out, this is civil as opposed to criminal, so it'll be a little bit easier and you get some information. But, I mean, how are you going to prove conspiracy? How are you just going to prove conspiracy that people got together to do this? This is just to aggravate the hell out of the Bush administration, and I'm sure the Democrats are going to be happy about it. But, I mean, I think it's – I'm basic – frankly, I am sick and tired of hearing about the whole affair. It's hard to figure out what are the merits of this case. I mean, initially, one might have understood there were some merits when we were talking about the criminal aspects of it. But as it turns out, it's only been perjury. And so it looks like it's, you know, they'll sell a couple more books and keep their names in the limelight. But this seems to me to be more of a publicity stunt than a lawsuit.
Let's take a look now at some numbers that are increasing. These numbers on the rise have concerned many people, and that's crime across the country, violent crime in particular. We just heard from William Bratton of the Los Angeles Police Department talking about community policing. And what we're finding is much of this crime is being committed by juveniles. I've got a number of relatives and very close friends on police forces across the country. And I was sitting with one most recently, and he talked about the idea that these kids are the kids that were born to the crack era, if you will, mid to late 80s, and they are fearless, Nat Irvin. The idea that they are committing crimes based on the idea that many of these video games that we talk about, this kind of get rich or die trying attitude, the idea that they have not been raised by parents who have had the ability and wherewithal to teach right from wrong, really culminates in what we are seeing today.
Well, I tell you, Ed, you mentioned fearless. My wife and I sometimes will volunteer here for the one of the juvenile programs designed to try to intervene on behalf of young people before they get into the, you know, the more serious aspects of the criminal justice system. One of the questions we always ask is, what are you afraid of? And let me tell you, we are always shocked by the responses. There are a number of young people, and you've described that some of them haven't been born to crack mothers. Listen, I'm telling you, they are not. Some of these young people are not afraid of anything. They're age 13. They're 14 and 15. I don't think it has anything to do. It may have something to do with video games. I doubt it. I just think it has to do with lack of family structure, having not had any role models. And I often, when I leave that session on Saturdays, I'm telling you, I am worried about a certain segment of our young people. Yeah. And to think that this is in some of the larger cities, hey, we've got something that we're going to have to deal with here shortly.
Michael, the idea of video games, many people suggest that it does have something to do with it in the sense of you get so used to just shooting people without consequence that, you know, we see the idea of trivializing death and have done that for perhaps the last generation or so.
Well, media has always trivialized death, but the problem of youth violence is really now much more extensive than when we always had violence in the movies and films and video games. And I know lots of people who do video games and violent games and know they're not really killing people, and it really doesn't affect them. But I think that violent crime has always been a youth cohort. And with respect to drugs and running for the older folks, young people have been the persons who have been involved with crime and who have been put into prison. The thing about Commissioner Bratton's comments were very interesting. When he talked about community policing, what in the heck is community policing in Los Angeles? Because you have so many different kinds of communities, communities he's even trying to get used to. Los Angeles and New York are so different. In New York, 38,000 cops. That's how he got the he took a bite out of crime in New York. 38,000 cops. They were everywhere. They were visible. They were on your block, on your back, undercover, in cars, in taxi cabs. They were everywhere. And and that's how they took a bite out of crime in New York. And
Joe, what do you do? What do you do with these young kids who people are suggesting some, and we all have heard it, who believe that this is a generation that you just throw away? You cannot do that. So how do you curb this problem and rein them in, quite frankly?
Well, I think one of the things that we need to do is we need to find a way to give these kids some hope for the future. You know, Nat talked about them being fearless. I think that's a part of it. But I think that part is also driven by an expectation of death. A lot of these kids don't expect to live beyond 20 or 25, and they will tell that to you. There were stories in the Washington Post years ago about young girls planning their funeral, you know, 13-year-old girls planning their own funerals.
I spoke with a young woman who actually bought the dress for that.
You know, well,
that, let them plan their funeral, but I want them planning mine.
But that kind of situation, though, it's not exactly self-hatred in this particular case, but it's this expectation that I will die anyway. Mm-hmm. So it really doesn't matter, you know, what I do. And that manifests itself in different ways for different people, but for some, it makes them take on this attitude of fearlessness and going out with a gun, and if I get shot and, of course, is shooting somebody, so be it. I'm going to die anyway.
I think
we really need to find a way to give these folks some hope for the future.
We heard it so prolifically in the words and songs of Tupac Shakur, who, if I can quote, said, "Ain't no hope for the future," as he talked about what young people believed. And we certainly hope that those words do not ring true. We'll take a look at these numbers down the line and see as police try to curb these problems. Michael, greatly appreciate you coming in at the last minute. And Joe and Nat, have a good weekend, and thank you so much.
Hey, thank you.
Great
too.
Weekend, guys.
All right. Bye-bye.